Hello and welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. We are here today sitting backstage at our conference. And my name is Chris Cover. I'm an editor at netzpolitik.org. Here with me is my colleague Alex. Hello, Alex. And our very esteemed guest for today, Lawrence Lessig, who is a hero of the copyright movement. And we have the pleasure of speaking to him today. You spoke at the conference earlier. And now we would like to take this chance to talk a little bit about your work and also later on talk about a current issue that's going on right now around the Media Lab. But so we'll get a little bit into that later on. But yeah, maybe just get started, okay. Alex.
Okay, great. So I was going to ask you a little bit about kind of the last 20 years and what happened in the sphere you're inhabiting. You became very well known with a series of books that dealt with issues of copyright. You were an important advocate for Creative Commons. So your advocacy for copyright reform, you know, kind of has led from this Free the Mickey Mouse moment in the 1990s to Creative Commons and to generally advocating for more openness in regard to copyright for free licenses and so forth. So I want to talk to you a bit about the recent European Union debate around copyright reform, which kind of didn't go the way that a lot of Creative Commons and generally digital rights activists had hoped it would go. So in a way, the whole debate, especially around mandatory upload filtering, showed that the right holders still hold a lot of political sway. So have you kind of given up in the light of that on advocating Creative Commons?
Well, no, I haven't given up. Although, you know, it's now 12 years ago that my friend Aaron Swartz convinced me that there was no reason to continue to fight for reform of copyright or internet policy so long as I lived in a deeply corrupted democracy. And it was that conversation that night that led me to announce that I was going to stop my actual advocacy in the context of copyright, because the democracy in America, at least, was so deeply corrupted that the problems that we were facing were not problems that were going to be solved by explaining the problem. It wasn't a problem of stupidity or ignorance or not understanding. It was a problem of corruption. It was that the system is so dependent on these few wealthy people who fund campaigns that they have no choice but to think any way differently. And unfortunately, I think we see the same thing happening in Europe. You know, it's not as corrupt, it's not as grotesque, because this, you know, we don't have the same kind of political funding system in Europe that we do in the United States. But the dominance of lobbyists and the games of the lobbyists has really changed dramatically over the last 20 years. And the capacity, like, it's really elegant to watch, but the capacity to take what is basically legislation designed to benefit incumbent large companies and to frame it as if it's about protecting artists, it's really genius. I mean, I wish I had that talent to name and rename so that you are confused about the politics here. But what Europe has done is basically, it's kind of, you know, even though Google formally was against it, it's the Google Protection Act. Because what it will do is make it so that the only companies that are able to provide internet service of this type of stuff are companies that are big enough to provide this type of filtering. And this type of filtering itself is so destructive of the opportunity of new generation of creators. I just did a talk where I highlighted, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to repeat his name, but there's this extraordinary creator who teaches guitar lessons using YouTube. So he, you know, he just does, you know, a series of lessons about how to play the guitar. And he will do, like, you know, certain openings or certain riffs that are like the standard opening and riffs of guitar. And when he does them, the Content ID technologies discover that they happen to be like some copyrighted song. Of course they're like a copyrighted song. They're like the common repertoire of what it is to be a guitarist. But he finds it, and then they automatically take demonetize his series, so he can't collect any money from the views that people are making of him. Nobody's viewing him because they're trying to get the underlying music, you know, the six riffs or six bars that give them a sense of how to play a certain riff. They're listening to him because they want to learn how to play the guitar. So it makes no sense for him to continue to provide this creative educational service, because we've turned the platform into the perfect surveillance platform, not to benefit creators, but to benefit the collecting rights societies or to benefit the incumbents who are eager to control or to monetize or to block that kind of creativity.
Yeah. So now we have these large, very powerful incumbent platforms who also hold a tremendous political sway. They have built up this large lobby apparatus. And at the same time, you know, you still have this kind of legacy industries, the creative industries, film, music, the publishers. And I sometimes get the impression that open platforms, open ideas, and projects like Wikipedia get kind of trapped in the middle between these two, that they have not been able to carve out a political space of their own. So they get, you know, in factional debates, they get stuck on either side. So is there a way of, for instance, in promoting Creative Commons, open licenses and so forth, in a way that does not end up favoring the big five companies, especially Google and Facebook?
Well, I think that in context where you really see the energy around Creative Commons licensing, it has that effect. So one of the most important places where you see growth and energy around these licensing is the open education movement. Because what people increasingly realize is that we have these extraordinarily talented people called teachers in the world, and we don't get the opportunity to leverage their knowledge outside of their own classroom. Right? So if you're a person who's been teaching fifth grade math for 30 years, you know something about how to teach fifth grade math. And the idea that your knowledge gets trapped in that one classroom is outrageous, right? If we had a way to get that knowledge out and to share it more broadly, then we could really dramatically improve the opportunity for education. And the open education movement is effectively doing that by making materials available, which people are able to take and remake as they think best, and then relicense them for other people to take, displacing a model of kind of one-way publishing, which is the model that has dominated education for so long. Now, in that context, when those people create in this way, they're creating content that might be hosted on Google, or it might be hosted wherever. They're creating content that might be printed through Amazon or available through Kindle Books or whatever. So it's not like they're not helping these big five. They're not helping the big five in a way that blocks the opportunity for others to do the same thing. My view is Creative Commons has an important role in these crucial niches of culture and knowledge. And Wikipedia is just the most visible of those. But the open science movement, the open education movement, the open knowledge movement are also incredibly important parts of a knowledge ecosystem. And this has become the kind of cornerstone to enable that to be protected.
But do you still feel that something has to be done urgently about the dominance of the platforms? I mean, you had prominent Democrats like Elizabeth Warren coming forth and saying, well, maybe we should disentangle, we should break up these companies. European legislators have been also thinking the same thoughts, talking the same ideas. So what is your position on this?
I absolutely think that the decision that was effectively made 20 years ago to turn off antitrust regulations in the digital environment was a mistake. You know, the last big technical case was the Microsoft case, literally 20 years ago. And the eagerness of these platform companies to become, to leverage their power into even more exclusionary power is much greater than what Microsoft was demonstrating at the time. And the openness with which they would leverage their power to exclude others is much greater than what Microsoft would have done at the time. And I think the reason is they basically have recognized that the government is just afraid to take them on, and it won't take them on. Now, you've got presidential candidates who are talking about it. Elizabeth Warren's a colleague and a friend of mine, and I believe her when she says it. But, you know, the reality is government is not just a president, as much as Donald Trump imagined it was. But it's going to take a lot more than just that to make it possible to enforce antitrust law again. which is why I think in the United States, the thing we ought to be talking about first is what do we do to get us a democracy that can actually represent the people as opposed to a system that is increasingly benefiting powerful interests that just happen to find a way to sell it to politicians.
So then I'd lead on to kind of the...
Yeah, okay. So we wanted to take this opportunity to also talk to you about something that has been unraveling this week and something that you wrote over the last weekend. So over the past couple of days, increasingly it has come to light that the MIT Media Lab had very strong ties with Jeffrey Epstein and has taken money from Jeffrey Epstein, and that Joey Ito, who was director of the lab, had close ties with Jeffrey Epstein. And I thought it was really interesting. You wrote a very emotional piece about this last weekend, in which you are very open and also speak about your own history and story of abuse, but then basically go on to make a lot of excuses for Joey Ito, who is also your friend, as you write in the piece. So I was wondering, why did you feel that you had to write this piece?
Sure. So first, I think it's important. I don't think I make excuses for Joey. I say Joey was wrong in doing what Joey did. I say he was wrong, and I was wrong, because when he asked me about what he should do, I didn't let my own experience speak. I let the framework of what he had described convince me, which he described heavy due diligence to assure him that him and MIT, that Jeffrey Epstein was not continuing his abuse. But the question you asked, like, why did I feel like I had to write that? You know, when Joey was originally, when this thing first broke, some of his friends created a website, We Stand With Joey. And they came to me and said, would you sign this? And I thought, oh my God, it is the last thing in the world I want to do, to be put into this position, to have to engage on this. But I can't be a coward and not stand up for my friend, who I think is being wrongfully scapegoated in this context. So I signed it. And then I thought I had to write about it. Why did I sign it? And the Joey's friends who were helping him in that moment said they didn't think it was good to be writing about it, at least at that moment. And then when Joey resigned, I felt like I could no longer not explain myself. I thought I had to explain myself. So I explained myself.
Just for context, so he stepped down on Saturday, I think, and that's after that you published your piece.
I wrote it on Sunday and published it on Sunday. So I had to explain myself, and that was my effort to explain myself. And the explanation, you know, just it's, you know, unfortunately it's a long piece, and so it's and not written over a long time, so I'm sure there's lots that's not clear about it. But just to be clear, you know, what I think is going on that angers the hell out of me is that yet again, we have an institution that has caused a problem that's scapegoating a particular person as if that's the source of the problem. And so you draw attention away from the institution to the person, and you don't think about the institution's role. And my view is the only way we're going to deal with these systemic problems of injustice is if we hold the institution to account. So in this case, my view is, you know, I said at the beginning, I'm so glad I don't have to raise money for universities, because I know I would have this moral conflict if I did. And the moral conflict is, I don't think universities should take money from criminals, and I don't think universities should take money for the purpose of laundering the reputation of people who take blood money and launder the reputation of people who have caused great harm.
Which is what Epstein has arguably done by donating to not just MIT and the Media Lab, but also a lot of other institutions.
Right. So Epstein certainly was trying to launder his reputation. And, you know, so my view is Epstein's money, we don't have any reason to believe that Epstein's money is blood money in the sense that he wasn't engaged in sex slavery. He made money you know, could turn out. We don't know. It could turn out, but nobody at the time believed that that's what his source of his money was. They thought his source of his money was this kind of savant-like ability to engage in investing. So the money he had was not directly from the crime, which is why I think of it as a different category from, for example, money from R.J. Reynolds, or money from the Koch brothers, or money from the Sacklers, which is money that grows out of the crime. In my view, both of those universities should stay away from. But the reality is universities take that money. And then the question is, okay, if you're going to take that money, how should you take it? And the argument in my piece was, well, you should not be in the business of laundering the reputation of bad people. So if you're going to take their money, which I don't think you should, but if you're going to take it, at least take it anonymously. Now, the piece then says, look, except what I realize now and what Joey and MIT missed as well, is that even if you have that as a rule, there are certain kind of crimes that you should never take the money from, even if it's anonymous. Because if it comes out, which inevitably it sort of thing comes out, it creates such pain and harm to people because of the nature of the crime. So if MIT had a guy who was convicted of tax fraud and then spent the rest of his life earning, you know, a vast amount of money, and then takes that vast amount of money that he earned in, you know, decent ways and wants to give it to MIT, you might say, okay, MIT, if you're going to take that money, take it anonymously so you're not turning the tax fraud into a good person, not like, you know, like Rockefeller. Everybody thinks Rockefeller's a great person because they have so many great Rockefeller gifts. But Rockefeller was a criminal, a racist criminal, yet, you know, he's succeeded in washing his reputation. At least don't take the money and wash the reputation. But there's a difference between taking money from a tax fraud and taking money from a pedophile. Because when you discover, if you accidentally discover, that your building is built in part from a tax fraud, not from the money of tax fraud, but just somebody who was convicted of tax fraud, you're like, oh, well, at least we got the money from that criminal. But if you discover that you're in a building that's funded in part, or a program that's funded in part by a pedophile, and you're a victim yourself, I know what that feels like. And that's the blindness, I think, that MIT had, and that Joey had, and that I frankly had, when I didn't think through the contingency of this coming out. But, you know, what frustrated me to write that in when I did was, you know, that had come out. So Joey resigned on Saturday because of a piece that came out in The New Yorker on Friday,
reported by Ronan Farrow.
Right. Yeah. And the piece by Ronan Farrow made it sound like Joey was rogue, that, you know, he was doing all this stuff against the policies of MIT.
And you wanted to point out that it was actually with the knowledge of people higher up in the administration and not just a private decision that he took in secret.
Yeah. And so we should condemn the decision, but the idea that we should hold harmless the institution that knowingly participated was just outrageous to me. And when I said that, and I said in the piece that, you know, MIT clearly knew, I had so many news organizations call me and say, why do you believe MIT knew? And that was astonishing to me, first of all, because does anybody really expect that an institution like MIT takes and cashes a check from somebody for hundreds of thousands of dollars without figuring out who that person is? I mean, they have an office whose only job is to take money and to clear, like, who the money is from. So it's astonishing anybody would be misled by what Ronan had said. But, you know, I felt like MIT was just, you know, allowing this ambiguity to work to their benefit. Now, to Reif's, the president of MIT's, you know, to his credit, yesterday he released a letter where he said, we knew it was going to be anonymous. We knew he had been convicted of a crime. We believed, like Joey did, he was not continuing his crime, and that's why we did it, and that was a mistake. So they've confessed to the same wrong that Joey is.
I do agree with you. I'm absolutely on the same page with you when it comes to that it's not about, that it's the bigger institutional problem and that it shouldn't be about one person, in this case, Joey Ito. But what struck me, like two points struck me, I think, in what you wrote and what you said now. One was that basically, and also when I'm reading through the responses and the reactions on Twitter, I think a lot of people were really irritated to really angry by the point that basically you're writing about the Media Lab, about the Media Lab's loss of a great director, and about him being a scapegoat, making him the victim of the story, without even mentioning the victims of Jeffrey Epstein, who have also started speaking up about the abuse.
So this is the part of the part I just don't get. The whole arc of my argument, the whole reason why taking money from Jeffrey Epstein is different from taking money from a tax fraud, hangs on a paragraph, two paragraphs, where I talk explicitly about the pain suffered by victims. It's about the victims that makes this difference. And in my own blindness that I say, I intellectualized this too much not to recognize the feeling that I had when Joey told me he was talking to Jeff Epstein. You know, because the feeling in my head was a punch in the gut. And it was because I was experiencing exactly what I would then covered my eyes to when I was talking to him about the technical conformity to the rules MIT had set about whether he could take the money or not. Was he engaged in continuing criminal harm? So I just reject the fact that the claim that this article doesn't, you know, respect or engage the victims. You know, I don't say it's misreading. You know, obviously, you know, as the great Frank Luntz, who I say that only because he was a college friend of mine, even though he's a right-wing guy in the States, but the great Frank Luntz said, it's not what you say, it's what's heard. Okay, I accept that it's not heard enough in what I said. But what I said was it's because of the nature of the pain felt by victims that this is different. And not being aware of that, being blind to that, or not expressing it, that was the error that MIT and Joey and I made. And as I said at the end of that paragraph, you know, instead of explaining to Joey, I should have wept, because I think if he had seen what I felt when he said this to me, you know, as it brought back these memories of like what this kind of abuse is, then I think he would not have imagined that it could ever be cabined or limited.
And that's the other thing that was astonishing to me, both in the argumentation that Ito brought forward as you retell it in your story, and basically the higher leadership of MIT now is saying, is the fact that, well, he was already convicted of the crime. Epstein was already convicted as a sexual abuser at the time, and then to go and say, well, that was in the past, we think he's changed, is also, I find in a way, really another way of disregarding that pain that you're just describing of the people who he has abused, to just say, it's like, well, he's convicted, but we believe him, he's doing better now, so I think it's fine, we can take his money. Do you see that problem?
Well, again, you know, because I think this is a special kind of pain, I do think the fact that he was not continuing to commit the crime should not have mattered.
Exactly. But
there is this, you know, there's a very interesting other person that was a fellow at the Media Lab for a while, a really wonderful artist named Shaka. Shaka had murdered somebody. He had spent 20 years in jail, and he got out and he became an incredible artist. And Shaka's a friend, and he is an incredibly sweet soul, and I see him with his, like, five-year-old son. This summer I saw him with his son, and he has such love and such connection. And Shaka was somebody that Joey brought into the Media Lab. You know, what was the expression that Joey was making when he brought him to the Media Lab? It wasn't that I disregard the victim that was murdered by Shaka. And there was no ambiguity. This was like an accident. This was murder. It's that I'm taking him as someone who's done his time and we're going to move on from that. As long as I believe you're not going to murder again, right? Now, even though I think murder, you know, even... weird we have to say this, murder is worse than this kind of abuse. I still think it's okay to have Shaka at the Media Lab, and I don't think it's okay to have Jeff Epstein at the Media Lab. So I'm acknowledging that there's a blindness, But the formality, the formal point is, I think, what was guiding it. You were convicted. You did your time. And so therefore, we take you now going forward. And that I'd be perfectly happy with 90% of the crimes, perhaps. But some crimes, I think it's just wrong to ignore what had happened in the past.
And then there's also the points that you don't mention the piece, which is that it wasn't just about taking money. It was actually about also bringing Epstein to visit the Media Lab, at least on one occasion, I think it's proven. And also Ito seemingly having a relationship with him that extended way beyond that whole philanthropist situation. He visited, he took money for his personal VC funds. He visited him in his mansions, on his island. So it really seems like, and I think he mentioned, at least on one occasion, it says in the New York Times, their own therapies, that he was fascinated by him as a person. It really seems that you can really kind of tell he was just fascinated by Epstein. He wanted that connection with him.
Yeah, and the story as told makes it seem like Joey was unique in this respect. But what the MIT is now doing is conducting a massive investigation of all of the people at MIT who had the same fascination with Jeff Epstein. You know, it's common knowledge at MIT, for example, that one of my heroes, Noam Chomsky, would go on vacations with Jeff Epstein, with Noam Chomsky and his wife would go on vacations with Jeff Epstein. And that's not because Noam Chomsky had some weird perversion or any desire to be exposed to that. It's because he found him to be a fascinating guy. You know, so what's going to happen is the story will, as the story unfolds, be that he was a fascinating guy. I never met him. I had no basis for saying that from firsthand knowledge. I'm just inferring that you don't get time with great people at MIT that he's not giving money to any of these people. He's just because he's an interesting person to engage with. And again, it raises this question, like if that's what it's about, then what line should you be drawing because of the particular things that he had done in his past, or at least that he was convicted of in his past. The other thing about this is I actually don't think it's right to say, you know, beyond the kind of places where one might acknowledge the fascination of this person, I think it's important to remember that what Joey was doing in the context of this relationship was acting as a fundraiser, both for his fund. I mean, and again, MIT was totally okay at the beginning when Joey went there, that he continued to run his own investment fund, and for the institution. If you talk to fundraisers about what their job is, it is about cultivating friendships with the people who are going to be giving you money. In my view, if MIT had done what it should have done in the very beginning and said, Jeff Epstein is not one of our donors, period. You know, Jeff Epstein gave money to Harvard before he was convicted. After he was convicted, the rule at Harvard was no more Jeff Epstein money, period. And Harvard has done a review and they say, we've had no more Jeff Epstein money after that conviction. If MIT had adopted the same rule, I don't think Joey Ito would have had any relationship with Jeff Epstein, right? Why would he? Because, you know, he's got to raise money for the institution. He's going to go to the places he can go. So, you know, I think when the context is painted, again, the Farrow article does a good job in making Joey seem perverted because of this fascination. And, you know, one can make one's judgment, but you should make the judgment on the basis of the facts. And the facts are that the institution, I'm not saying MIT, I'm saying people at that institution, many of them had this, quote, fascination. You know, he was present because of that fascination. Now, the other point that Farrow makes that I think, again, is just, I just don't get, is if you have decided the only way you can take this money is anonymously because you don't want to whitewash his reputation or whatever, then steps taken to keep it anonymous are consistent with that. You know, if you're a reporter and you have a source who's anonymous and you take steps to keep that source anonymous, that's what you're supposed to do, right? So the idea that taking steps to keep the connections anonymous is in some sense nefarious just doesn't seem to me to make sense if you're right that it should be kept anonymous. Again, saying, bracketing, because people don't hear this enough from what I said or what I wrote, again, bracketing whether you should be taking this money at all, which I both think you should never have taken Jeff Epstein money, and you shouldn't be taking criminal money, I mean, money from criminals, period. And type, what I call type four, blood money, you should never be taking. But if you take it, if you take money from Sacklers or you take money from the Koch brothers, then at least don't allow them to pretend that they're great people, despite the harm that they've done.
With hindsight, would you have written the article again the way you did? Would you say that it was that the article kind of, as you said before, intellectualized the whole issue a little bit too much?
No. I didn't say that. What I said was that I had intellectualized my own abuse so much that when Joey talked to me about it, I didn't let the emotion speak. I spoke to him as a lawyer. Would I write the article differently? Well, to the extent people don't hear the voice of victims in the article, then I failed in the article to convey what I mean. I thought it was there. There's no logic to me ultimately coming around and saying, I made a mistake here, that doesn't hang on recognizing the voice of women or the voice of victims. Of course, many of these victims, not Jeff Epstein's, but many of the victims of pedophile are not women. That's the point. I'm not a woman. I'd be, eager to, if I had a chance again, to make that clearer, two more paragraphs, like saying the same thing again, louder, bigger, bolder font, maybe. But I had no illusion that I would write this article and the world would say kumbaya, right? That's just not the nature of this debate. Like, there's no way. I just felt I had to explain what I had done, because many people I respect had said to me, what have you done? Why would you do this? And so I had a burden of explanation, which I would have much rather have never had to engage. And I wouldn't have had to if I hadn't been asked to sign something and didn't feel like I had no, that it would have been just cowardice to back away from signing it. So I signed it. I knew if I signed it, I'd have to explain it. I knew if I explained it, I was going to make a whole bunch of people upset. But there I am. That's where I am.
Well, thank you for speaking so openly about something that is hard and answering all our questions. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, you might want to check out our earlier podcast. There's several English language ones. Also, the majority is in German, though. And if you're listening to the podcast on some kind of channel where you can like us, then please do give us a good rating. It will make us more visible and will us reach a larger audience with the podcast. Also, we are financed almost entirely by donations. So if you think we're doing a good job and we should continue doing that job, you might want to consider donating to netzpolitik.org. And thank you for listening.